Recording in progress.
All right, we'll start with introductions. I'm Chuck Adams, one of the co-chairs. I'm just taking an order as I see on my screen. Jordan, just say hello.
Oh,
Okay. Stephen.
hi. My name is Stephen. So I'm the HCAP attorney at the AIDS Legal Referral Panel, and I'll just briefly introduce Jordan is our law clerk. She's been supporting on this the HCAP annual report, and so I invited her to join in the meeting
Oh,
today.
okay.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Oh. You froze, Chuck.
Yes, I did. So am I back?
Yes.
All right, Na.
Hi, Nolly, council member.
Jan.
You want to ask us some council member?
Let me see. Whoops. TJ.
Hi, TJ Lee Miyake, council.
There we go. Thomas.
Thomas Noble, government co-chair. Are they them? I'll be on camera in a minute.
All right,
Thanks.
Marco.
Yeah. Thank you, Chuck. Good afternoon, everyone. Marco Montenegro, Mission Neighborhood Health Center, Clinic Esperanza, council member.
Great. Natalie.
Hi, Natalie, SFDPH HHS.
Kira.
Kira, council staff.
Kat
That's council staff.
and Mark. Cool. All right. So this is the HIV Community Planning Council, Community Affairs Committee, Council Affairs Committee, Tuesday, March 10th. Now we're going to review and approve the March 10th draft agenda. Anybody see any changes that they want to make? If not, we'll accept that by consensus. Let's move on to the February 10th draft minutes. You see any changes, say? If not, we'll accept that by consensus also. Now we're ready for announcements. Does anybody have any announcements? Go ahead, Stephen.
Just quickly, I apologize. I have a client showed up needing an urgent notarization, so I'll have to hop off after we provide the HCAP preview.
Okay.
Thank you. Sorry about that. I wasn't planning on that.
Any other?
I have a quick reminder for folks.
Yes.
If you haven't completed your 700 forms, we are quickly approaching the deadline. It is at the beginning of April, the very first day. So please make sure that you complete those.
All right, thank you. No public, so we'll move on to Stephen and the HCAP report.
Thank you so much. It is wonderful to be back here. Again, doing this another year. I'll just make a couple of notes, and then have I been made to be a host to share the slide deck, or should I?
Stephen.
Share. Can you all see me? Sweet. I'll give just a couple of notes quickly. First of all, this is my contract year ends on the first. I have a family obligation coming up at the end of the month that I'll be out for a couple of weeks supporting my brother. Mark was kind enough to let me do this immediately, but it does put me in a bind of having to get a lot done in a very short period of time. So I've only had a week to review this data. Jordan has been already in such a short amount of time made herself indispensable, has proven to be incredibly forethoughtful and resourceful. And so she has helped me put a lot of this together. That being said, a lot of the data, while here, has not been really analyzed. So that's on our agenda for tomorrow. There are some placeholder slides. I think you guys have seen the presentation. Most people here have seen the presentation before. It will, there's nothing, really revelatory, as far as I can tell. But I'll point out some of the trends that I can see at this point without having really fully reviewed all the data that we have. So I intend to begin the presentation as I always do, just talking about the HCAP program and my approach to it. I will proceed to talk about the inception of it from as a basically a child, a brainchild of the Planning Council. And I think you all have seen how I approach the work. I'll make sure that all the council members and anybody that's attendant there will understands the program. This year we had 101 unduplicated clients. If you remember last year, it was 100. So we haven't made any, no crazy changes to that. We had 126 HCAP matters, which is a slight decrease by 2 cases. As you know, there are, many clients or multiple clients that come in with more than one HCAP issue. And so that's why there's more cases than unduplicated clients. The bulk of clients were in San Francisco. I think we had one. I don't know if you remember, Jordan. I think we had one in Marin this year and 3 in San Mateo, and we'll make sure that's on the slide. And then breakdown again, nothing revelatory. There was a sign. There was, I would say, the largest increase is within the race and ethnicity. We had an increase in Latine consumers, and I would say, anecdotally, without having like reviewed each individual case, I would say some of that is a result of the increase in need for immigration support amongst that population who also have needs around their basic needs. And so oftentimes when somebody comes in and consults with our immigration team, which now is doing full scope litigation, they also find that they need housing or they need emergency financial assistance to pay for their paperwork to, for their green card, or they need food, and we have been, supporting the immigration team to that extent through the HCAP program as well, and wanting to make sure that we're documenting the needs of that community. Not a huge change. It's not news to anybody that a significant percentage of our cases are housing services cases. As you know, that could all either be for housing subsidies, or it could be supportive services within some residential environments like an RCFCI or a TRCF. And so, once I get into that data, I'm sure we'll come up with some particular cases that are notable that we can talk about. Dental services, there was an increase in dental services this year. Not with cases. Actually, there were a couple of terminations of dental services. I don't think it's anything of the kind of, in the same vein as when I know that prior to my tenure here, there was a significant increase in terminations of services from dental provider. That is not that's I'm not seeing that just yet, but it is a notable thing. Once I get into the data again, I'll hash it out a little bit more in the report and make sure to report appropriately. Over 74% of our cases are either referrals, access issues, or quality of care issues. Typically, that's handled through grievances. I did file a number of grievances this year. 12 grievances were filed, as opposed to 15 last year. As far as terminations, we had a 50% success rate in turning these over. The providers have been, supportive to the extent that, a client has, disabilities. One of the suspension was actually And I will hash this out so I can talk a little bit more eloquently and speed and concisely about it. But sometimes the decision is sustained, but it comes in tandem with some sort of accommodation. So we won't do this, but what we will do is we'll support or draft a letter, or right. I try to make it so that the providers can at least support us to the extent where we can get to the client to the next step in their care plan or the next step in obtaining what it is that they need. But I think a 50% success rate in overturning terminations is pretty good. We had I'll hash this out a little bit more, but I know we dug into the data here, and Jordan, what is it, 17% of I think 17% of my clients are repeat customers from the previous year. I know that when I talked about the benefits of that last year, the council was curious about how many there were, and so I've updated that. I'll update that information for this year's presentation. But some of the benefits of that are, I have clients that show up for whatever their need is, and at least it's a touch point for them accessing care. At this point, I have clients that I've been seeing, on a monthly or bi-monthly basis for 6 years. I know how they look. I know how they present. I'm not a medical provider, but I can certainly tell when they need a little bit extra help and can gear them in the right way. These are placeholder slides. I don't have an analysis of each of these data points. As I said, I've only had a week to go through these. These are the slides from last year. And I'm not sure well, I know that this is not relevant because I haven't seen a whole lot of cases around LAI. I think it's becoming much more commonplace. This was, and maybe that's worth even noting, but I know that last year it was kind of still a beginning process for a lot of clinics and overcoming, those challenges. Again, some of these, we're still actually the one place we're in the data that we don't currently have yet is our feedback. So once I get that together, I will again add that to the slide. And I apologize, but that's pretty much all it is. The data is here. We have the data. I just need to sift through it and come to some sort of conclusion and impression from it. And Jordan, was there anything else that I forgot to add or?
I don't think so.
Cool. I'm happy to. I would love any feedback that folks want to offer or suggestions, or if there's a particular curiosity based on the things that I've talked about either today or previously that you've heard me.
PJ.
I think Mark was before me.
Oh, I can't see his hand.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Go ahead, Mark.
Mark, we can't hear you.
Can't hear you, Mark.
I'm going to stop sharing.
Why don't I just go until Mark gets up
Yeah,
there?
go ahead, TJ.
Okay. Hey, first, Stephen, I want to say thank you very much. And thank you to Jordan. You always do an amazing job, and I'm glad. Glad you have support from Jordan. I really appreciate the fact that you told us the number of clients that compared to last year to this year. I really think that that's a good detail to have in. And I know it was mentioned last year, so I'm really happy to see that in. And I'm sure with your short time, you'll get everything taken care of. But, and good luck with your family matters.
Thank you. And
Go
I
ahead,
see
Mark. Want to try
Mark was
again?
working on it.
All right.
So a good question. So the question, in case anybody hasn't seen it, has there been any specific issue around dental providers not providing care to people with viral loads or detectable viral loads? So this isn't, yes, there was an issue. So, and I'll actually, Marco, if you're okay with me jumping on that when I provide the presentation, because I think that's actually kind of a juicy topic. As a person living with HIV, my dentist has never asked me for my viral count, like not once. And my understanding is that in private practice, they do not do it. The dental providers, as you know, that receive Ryan White Care funding, however, are teaching to a large degree teaching universities or teaching facilities, and they use a teaching model. And I think they're trying to support in doing some overall, making sure that the folks are asking appropriate questions during intakes and making sure they're getting a full medical history. And during an outreach, that question came up. I think there is some guidance around it, from like out in community, but it's mostly dictated by the policies internally, from at least the one dental provider where this kind of came up. When this issue comes up, I do think, not to put too fine a point on it, but one of the problems with my brother is he has a heart condition, and the last time he wound up in the hospital that's led to this most recent thing is he went to a dental provider, and although he bones up on antibiotics for like 2 weeks before any procedure, an infection caught and it went right to his heart, which has some weakened conditions already, and is incredibly dangerous for him. And the mouth is an access to a lot of really dangerous stuff. And so, and we know that from even HIV, back in the day, like, folks with thrush or, gingivitis, gum disease, those all increase risk of transmission, So, I do think that it makes sense to teach newer providers to have, to have that conversation and perhaps ask about it. I don't love, care being contingent on the answer. But if it's an internal policy, there's little I can do other than advocate. And the way that I have done that is by imparting on the providers that they need to be careful about how that question is asked. If they're asking the question from a place of, we want to make sure we're being safe, we want to make sure that you are not vulnerable, like, because you're not virally suppressed, because you have a whole body here that we need to care about. If the question is posed from that framework, it makes a whole lot more sense to somebody than if they feel like they're going to be denied services based on their HIV status. And so it's kind of in the instance that came up, it was kind of a conversation with the providers. It was a conversation with the client. The client was able to obtain services. And they're not asking for a viral count every time. They're asking
With a
it for
viral
it
count,
annually. What's up?
with a viral count that was like detectable, they were still able to actually,
Detectable.
yeah. Yeah, I asked. Thank you,
Actually,
Stephen, for
no.
the.
In fact, that I apologize. No, that client did not have a viral that client did not actually have a detectable viral load. They were asking for the paperwork and making the services contingent on having that paperwork.
Huh. And I do wonder, like, my question is coming specifically from two, it might be the same person who just left public comment twice over the course of a couple months, but they are worded differently. So maybe you think it was two people who have complained that they have not been provided services because they have detectable viral loads, which does not sound like a policy that other providers might have. I mean, I don't really have opinions on this other than. If there's any kind of discrepancy in how the service is provided and how people are excluded, I think that should be looked at by HHS. Anyway.
I don't know. I don't know what the where the complaints came from, or if they're the, if we ha if there were clients that came through my program. I can't think of an instance where I had a virally detectable client who was denied services by a dental provider off the top of my head. The case that I was thinking of was a case where the client was undetectable and was being told that they couldn't do work on them until they had a paperwork that showed their viral load, their viral being in the
Interesting.
central.
Okay. Well, I did forward this. I mean, I'll read the relevant sentence. This is anonymous. All of our public comment to the website is anonymous unless they actually put their name down. The relevant part is UOP refuses to treat anyone with a detectable viral load, even if it is too low to accurately measure. You know, which is a disturbing piece of public comment, but it is public comment. So I'm not sure, like, if it's connected to anything that you have seen. That's why I was curious.
I don't know, as an it's anonymous, so I can't say. I have no idea. I don't know whether it's even somebody that I've worked with, but what I can say is that I could foresee a situation where somebody perceives that as being what they, what they hear, but it's that is coming from an initial reaction, or like kind of a reflex, a very defensive reflex, and rightfully so, because I think,
Got
I think there is a lot of stigma. And in my outreach conversation, I can share, with at least one provider, I had the whole team, I had the whole dental team, and I'd never been in I loved talking with providers, but I showed up and it was like I felt like I was giving a lecture, because it was the everybody from the team. And one of the providers, she discussed, she was like, I don't, the question came up and we kind of talked about it, and was like, I don't know what Medi-Cal says, but if you have an internal policy, then we need to review that to make sure that it's not like, stopping care or denying care for no reason. And she shared that, like, back in the 80s, we used to see patients with HIV all the time, and we didn't even use gloves. So, like, there were other people in the room that were like, oh, like, what are we all worried about? So, I think there's probably a lot of anecdotal information to be had there, but I do want to make sure it's not coming from a place of stigma and or a very convenient way to deny somebody services that they don't want to provide services to, right? Those are the two main concerns. But I'll look into the cases, and I think that's a really important conversation for us to have. So thank you for the question, Marco. Hopefully it's okay with you if I hash that out more before the 23rd.
Mark, not Marco.
Oh, Mark. Oh, that was your question. I'm sorry, Mark. Sorry. I saw, I think, Natasha question. Natalie, sorry.
There's Elise,
Oh, Elise, okay.
TJ, and Jan.
Oh,
Yeah.
awesome.
Hey, everyone. Sorry, I joined a couple minutes late, so I apologize if this was already covered or has already been discussed, but I was surprised to hear you discussing this issue only because basically I'm nowhere near close to being a legal professional, but in school we learned about the, I think it was the Bragdon v. Abbott case that discussed it was a woman who was denied dental care specifically for disclosing that she had HIV. And I had no idea that there was a differentiation between like someone who is had like viral load or did not have a viral load. I didn't know that Uber was allowable to make that distinction in terms of providing care, denying care. So that's new information. Obviously, like I don't know a lot about the subject, but I was surprised to hear that.
So the concern, as I understand it, and again, I'm not a healthcare provider, and I mean, from a legal perspective, sure, there's concerns about that, but from a healthcare perspective, what I've heard is if somebody is immunocompromised and they're introducing, especially if it's like an oral surgery or something like that, if they're introducing, potential liability to somebody's overall health, it certainly makes sense that they know what they're getting into. If somebody, I mean, just from my perspective, like as a person living with HIV, if somebody thinks that what they're going to do is dangerous because of my, wherever I'm at in life right now, I certainly want to know that. I want to at least know. I think there's something to the consent and, informed
Right.
consent part of it.
Absolutely.
So I I'm not familiar with that case. I'll read up on it, but there's probably there, I can ima I can force I can imagine some legitimate reasons why you'd want to know somebody's viral count before you engage in especially like a pretty invasive thing. I mean, they're doing some pretty gnarly stuff, and they use some pretty, crazy materials in your mouth.
Totally. So it was more of like a concern of like patient-informed consent and disclosure of potential risk rather than concern
And the
from the
possibility of infection.
a possibility of infection rather than the concern from like the dentist and dental professional standpoint on them.
Correct. It
Okay.
was not, most of
Got
the,
it.
I have not heard of patients, I have not heard of dentists being concerned about their own transmission.
Oh, because I mean, we use universal precaution in every medical
Well,
field,
but
we
if
should be
it,
using
what,
it, so.
absolutely, but what you're saying is exactly what the patient hears. Right, if it's not presented in the right way,
Exactly, yes.
right? Because what the patient
Yeah.
hears is, what do you think I'm gonna give you? Right?
Right. Yeah, if
It's
it's
that's
not
when that's absolutely
clarified.
not the question, right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of people would not assume that, if they had never had any issues from a dental procedure before, I think it's very easy to not think, oh, I'm gonna get an infection that could lead to the rest of my body, if that's something that had not been explained in the past.
Okay, we got
Thank
a
you
couple
for
more
that.
questions. Jan?
I think TJ was ahead of me. But
Oh,
if
yours
I can
popped
go,
up
I can
first.
go. I mean,
Go ahead.
thank you. I was just gonna echo Stephen, and thank you for sort of pointing this out. Because I mean, these are not necessarily sort of I don't know if the handful of people who have talked to me about this have escalated your way. But sometimes this sort of like, general unfamiliarity with HIV and sort of like how it manifests in the blood work that is being asked for. Like, for example, like on our end, we changed the assay, a few years ago. So it's a super sensitive type thing, and like, functionally undetectable is either not detected or detected under 30, which would read abnormal. And I don't know if this sort of, corresponds with new students coming aboard or like new faculty coming into like the dental schools that are sort of like reviewing these, but we've had like a handful of people who have been essentially sent back, and then not necessarily denied care, but delays, because they're sort of like asking for additional information because they're quote unquote detectable. Which is just like a misread on the lab work itself.
Got it.
So like I don't know if those types of things have ended up on your plate, but like I would say that those are, there's a handful of people, two to three sort of, with fair amount of regularity that have some sort of, and usually it's like was pointed out at the beginning, and sort of like the bigger institutions who see a lot of Ryan White folks.
Well, for purposes of time and for the presentation on the 23rd, what I'll look to do is dig a little bit deeper into the cases that I had. Off the top of my head, I can't think of a situation where somebody was denied dental services and I was not able to get that overturned. So it may have posed delays. That's problematic. I want that to be changed. But I can't, I need to remember, this is all from like, potentially a year ago. So I need to go back to it to see exactly what happened and make sure that I'm addressing questions
Okay, TJ.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a long-standing practice of UOP because I was a client of theirs like in 2004 to almost 2008. And depending on how, if they were doing like root canals or something, I always had to provide that. And but it really depends on the tact of the instructor and the student that year, because sometimes it would be really good and sometimes it would be really horrible. And I would tell them, talk to them about how to say it in a better way. So, yeah, that's all I want to say.
Thank you.
Thomas.
Great. It's so funny because Stephen, I feel like you're the person I would call to ask the question that you're putting forth. Like, can't somebody deny somebody services? But I also just, from my dental experience, they ask me a series of questions, like, am I pregnant? Have I heart conditions and all the other stuff. So I'm like wondering if there's a, in your research, if you could just kind of look to see, do they deny somebody services if they're pregnant or indicate that they have a heart disease or something along those lines? Is the, it's not necessarily just an HIV specific, realm is what I'm thinking. So, like, if I have an
I
immune
well, so I wouldn't
compromised
have
system.
I know I don't have data on anybody. I don't have any clients who I think are pregnant or have recently had children, so I wouldn't have data on that particular issue.
I appreciate that. No, I'm thinking more around the fact that this is just like, is if this is a stigma, for lack of a better word, specifically to HIV, or is it just a
Oh,
standard of
are
practice?
there other vulnerabilities in the questionnaire that would cause similar delays? Gotcha. That's a good question. That's a good question, and it's one that I could ask, anecdotally. I don't, and I can find out from my colleague there. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you.
Of course.
All right. Thanks, Stephen, and we'll look forward to hearing from you on the end of the month.
Thank you all. Lovely to see you. See you in a couple of weeks.
All right, now we're going to move on to the COLA report. Kira.
Yeah, I can take that. So let me go ahead and share that. Okay. Oop. That jumped ahead. Can everyone see this?
Yes.
All right. Okay. So I'm going to go briefly through the COLA presentation. And so this year, or last year's target population was cisgendered women living with or at risk for HIV. And so starting off with some background, here there is a note about limitations. And so the limitations include a small sample size. So it's important to note that clients may not be representative of the demographics of this target population. There is also some thank yous to our collaborating partners. And this focus group took place in February of this year, so last month, and it yielded a total of 9 participants. Each participant was incentivized with a $50 Safeway gift card, and I was the one that facilitated this focus group. Here is some overview. I won't go through this, but this essentially includes our mission statement as well as give some background on the COLA and what the purpose of a COLA is. All right, and I did have our participants fill out the service category prioritization sheet. And so on this sheet, they essentially looked at all of these service categories and they ranked them from 1 to 10, from marking them from least important to most important. And so we came out with these results. And so those first three that are marked as most important for those participants were primary medical care, mental health care, and dental care. And then on the opposite end, you can see down there it was emergency and transitional housing, hospice, and home health care marked as the least important to folks. All right, as for the service category discussion, we mainly discussed these three service categories, and so that included primary medical care, where participants spoke about the quick turnover of medical staff. Also, pharmacy fulfillment system lacking follow-through, and then that going and affecting medication adherence. We also talked about case management, so saying that there were not enough case managers and that those case managers that were in place were not reflective of the Black or African American community. So there was a specific call out for clients wanting their service providers to also be reflective of those who they are serving. Moving on to transportation, folks did express that they were wary of cuts to the funding for transportation, and they noted the importance of this. So if they didn't have transportation, then they weren't able to get to their appointments. All right, moving on. When we were discussing challenges and barriers to care, the group was asked how their experience navigating the system of care felt. And so participants spoke about the support groups. They spoke about this a lot. And so a lot of the participants spoke about how they wanted to see more support groups that were specific for women, as the ones that were available, the support groups that were available, didn't feel inviting to them. Or were hard to come by. When talking about prevention, a lot of what was said was that there was a lack of HIV education. So sometimes the diagrams or abbreviations, for example, U equals U, could be confusing for people, especially if they weren't always aware of what that meant. Also, a lot of folks felt that they only received information about HIV after becoming infected. They weren't very knowledgeable about it before, and so that was surprising to them. And so I included some quotes down there, including, "Where's the prevention at? Spend some money to make it cool. It's not a death sentence anymore." We also discussed access to care. So folks felt that there was a lack of support around building different kinds of relationships. This specific issue was in reference to romantic relationships. So clients know that they themselves kind of are juggling a bunch of needs, but they also want to it to be known that they are also a person, and so they want to feel supported in living their lives. They also spoke about having to prioritize childcare, which can sometimes become a barrier when trying to access care, especially when there are activities or outings that aren't inclusive to parents. Down there, you can see navigating the system of care could feel tricky, especially because clients had to ensure that they don't double dip. And so, ensuring that if they're participating in a program, then if they want to participate in a different program, that they aren't double dipping, so they aren't participating in both of those because a lot of them have limitations. And so some quotes that I've included here are, "I'm fighting to get services for myself. I shouldn't have to fight for services they get funded for." "You have to be creative and know someone that knows the gray area." "No gap in paycheck, but there sure is a gap in care." And so to highlight some of the things that I will have talked about, this specific target population faces a unique set of challenges when navigating the system of HIV care. A lot of participants voiced concerns around the lack of education of HIV, which is also then connected to the prevention side as well. And then that gap in education contributes to the stigma that exists. There was a specific need for more consistent support groups that help serve the specific target population. Funding cuts were also top of mind for a lot of participants. They noted seeing these cuts actually implemented in social activities as well as transportation. And they also noted how the system of care works as a whole together. And so even reducing one part of that system of care definitely affects the rest of the system and affects their ability to stay engaged with the care. All right, so any feedback or comments? I see a thumbs up. Thank you.
Good job, Kira.
Thank you.
Yeah, I don't see any other hands. Are there any
Oh, I see
questions?
Thomas.
Thomas.
Yeah, I just wanted to say impressive as well. So, the second time I've heard it. So, it's helpful to hear it a couple times, tell you the truth, just because there's so much good information in it. And last time I just kind of talked about the absence of people being frustrated per se. I feel like women living with HIV is a small group of people in the city, and I can imagine that that must be a challenging experience. Just not being part of a larger group or seeking services has that, or even culturally relevant services might be an additional challenge. I did hear it this time, Kara. You do say it, right? That was some of their frustration, and I was like, okay, but it's not at the level that I thought it would necessarily be, just due to the fact of the numbers. And I also just appreciate the council kind of leaning into this, just because last year we did have a bump up of women acquiring HIV. It looks like that trend is not continuing for this year, which is good news, but we'll wait until the EPI report comes out and go from there. But every once in a while, we see like it goes 14, 14, 14, and then we last year was 24. And then it generally goes back down and then it'll bump back up. Cool. Thank you. Jan?
And I see Jan.
Kira, I keep I am so very impressed with your ability to kind of sort of put this together in a very nice way that also looks on point. Was there anything during the groups that surprised you in terms of feedback?
Yes, there was actually, I can recall two people that were newly diagnosed, now that Thomas actually mentioned it. And so it was also, I think, a lot of the feedback that I got and that Mark got was that a lot of the participants really appreciated that space, being able to discuss and talk, specifically because they talked so much about there being a lack of support groups for women with HIV specifically. And so there was a lot of knowledge that was being shared. Even after the group ended, folks stayed after, and there were folks taking down notes, exchanging numbers. So it was really nice to see, and really, I think it really highlighted and emphasized the need for that kind of space for these women.
And so in some ways
I would say that came out in our HIV and aging forum as well. There was a couple of voices that mentioned, this is obviously targeting for seniors, but there are a couple of folks there who talked about how there might be a women's COE and there might be a support group here and there, but they really felt in some ways invisible, even at the forum itself, actually.
Interesting.
Oh, I just wanted to share. I think we heard a lot of that feedback in Marin County as well. And then this most recent year, we've started, or the last 2 years, we've started a women's specific support group. And it's been so well attended that they, instead of meeting monthly, they've started meeting twice a month. And even though we've like set aside funds to, have food once a month, the other time that they meet, they're like, we'll make it a potluck. So I think we're seeing it like across the Bay Area. Like the women, they really do find a lot of value in meeting and convening together. And I think we've seen that feedback too, where it's like they don't want to see like friends or family members attend. And so the support group is really just for women living with HIV. So it's been successful so far. Just wanted to share, yeah, similar in Marin County.
All
What
right,
else?
thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Kira.
Of course.
All right. So I think that wraps it up for today. The next meeting will be April 14th, 3 to 4:30 p.m. And we'll see you then. We'll see you at the end of the month, rather, at the big meeting. So everybody take care and have a good rest of your day.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks. Hey, if my team and Thomas can stay on.
That doesn't feel uncomfortable.
Thomas.
Yeah, you're in trouble with all three of us. It's time for a triple team.